Hello there. Welcome to the Local Brown Bagger program on CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio, in Vancouver. As the news tells us every day, wars are being fought right now on almost every continent. What is the environmental impact of all this militarism? Perennial speaking favorite Chuck Sigmund spoke at the Vancouver Public Library on November 28, 2007. His topic was Global Warming Blues, the Impact of War on the Environment. Sigmund is a popular lecturer at Langara College, and this speech concluded their fall series. It was recorded by CFRO for the Local Brown Bagger program every Tuesday. Before beginning his talk, Chuck Sigmund played this song by James Brown. Is Chuck Sigmund.
Good afternoon. My feeling is that that particular song conveys to me the general idea, sonically and intellectually, of war. What I wish to do today is to emphasize two different things. One is the nature of war with respect to our planet. Planet Earth, spaceship Earth, and secondly, to briefly discuss with you, having absorbed certain facts, kinds of practical actions that you can take. But before I do that, I want to introduce a very brief ritual. I brought a balloon of the planet Earth. I think it's very appropriate being semi-transparent and quite fragile. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to begin to pass it around the audience. And regardless of what I'm saying or what your environment is, take the earth, the symbol of the earth, and hold it, look at its fragility, move it around, and for a brief period of time, just think about our stewardship of our spaceship, of our planet, of our earth. What is our role? What is our responsibility besides living on it? What do we have to give back to the earth that it gives to us? And what is our relationship with the earth? And how fragile actually is it? And how much abuse can it take? And how much abuse should it take from us? Also, I want to emphasize something, that much of the information that I'm going to give you relates to wars engaged in or conducted by Canada and the United States and a few selected European nations. I do not mean in any way to suggest that these wars and these data are in any way exceptional. I do not believe historically that the United States or Europe or Canada has been any better or any worse with regard to its dealing with the environment through war. It's simply a fact that this information was more accessible, was easier for me to get a hold of, and it's, I think, typical of the information available. So I'm not suggesting that there are wars that are more healthy for the environment and wars that are less healthy for the environment. I also want to emphasize something about the currency that we use within our global economy to get things done. The currency is money. And I simply wish to emphasize how much money even directly is spent in order to prepare for war, to conduct war, and to try to deal with the aftermath of war. The United States of America has now confirmed its budget for 2008. The military budget in the United States is going to be increased by $50 billion, that's right, $50 billion in 2008 over 2007. That's simply the inflationary amount. One other thing that totally amazed me, and this was not from a critic of the war, this is from the Congressional Budget Office. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that the cost of the Iraq War, not the military, but just the Iraq War, is $215,000 a minute. $215,000 a minute. So think of the time we're here. If we put currency in one area, it's like anything else. We can't put it in another area. We know that we're strapped for funds to deal with remediation of the damage that we've done to the earth, let alone to take protective and sustainable measures. Okay, enough of that. There's another thing, excuse me, there's another thing I wish to mention, and that is I do not in any way wish to diminish the effect that we are having through the emission of carbon dioxide on the planet's climate. I do believe that climate warming, that global warming, is a problem. It's a problem that should be addressed. It's an imminent problem. But I do not believe, from what I know, that the danger to the earth from global warming is nearly as severe as it is from global war. That the impact of war is so much greater. The earth, in fact, can survive global warming quite well, thank you. One of the things that would happen is the carrying capacity for human beings, for our species, and I'm quite willing to say that I am a human chauvinist, but the impact on our species is quite great. On the planet Earth as a planet is not very significant, the fact that the temperature would go up. However, the potential from the effects of war and the preparation of war are much more damaging to the planet. I also want to point out my belief that our planet, Spaceship Earth, hosts much more of value than just our species. That all living organisms, plants and animals, have value, they have a place on our planet, and should not be considered material that we can simply use for our desires and our ends. Having said that, I have, before I get started with some other material, one more important idea that I wish to present you with, and you can toss it over in your mind and see what you think. I think that in the world today, there is much concern, as there always has been, but perhaps even more, on security. On security for human beings. And I contend that comprehensive human security has two large portions, maybe two sides of a coin. One is social, and it's always emphasized, and it should be. Social has various components. Social security. It has a political component. It has an economic component. And of course, very importantly, it has a personal component. People want to get on with their lives and live their lives in a reasonable way. However, in addition to social security, there is environmental security. Environmental security involves protection of the natural environment and interacting with that environment in a sustainable way. And I contend something that seems to be common sense to me, and I suspect is common sense to you, that these two elements of security are inextricably linked. You can't have one without the other. You can't have social security without environmental security, and you can't have environmental security without social security. So I give that as a basis for the few arguments that I wish to present to you today. Now, I'd like to divide this impact of war really into three areas. You have the war, which is most dramatic, and the effects are most great over the short term. But you also have the preparations for war, and you also have the aftermath of war. So I'll start with the most dramatic, those of the actual waging of war. Now, it was early recognized that an army cannot fight on an empty stomach. Food, whether it's processed in a factory or picked directly from a field, always depends on the environment. Food comes from the environment. And when I was looking for, I guess, ancient records, and I have to be very honest with you, I didn't look months and months, I looked minutes and minutes. I found a reference in 300 BC to a Roman general, in the war against Carthage, in which he instructed an entire regiment of his army, as they conquered, to come behind and salt all the croplands in Carthage. Because, of course, if you salt the croplands, the ability to produce food for the army will be gone. Certainly, when you look at wars, the Peloponnesian War, the wars which I would call the wars in the Roman period, the Roman Empire period, even the Pax Romana, the peaceful period, when they were fighting less wars than in the warlike period, burning the environment, burning forests, burning crops, and salting were common ways of dealing with the environment in order to assure a greater chance of winning the war. I was very interested in reading some of the comments that Albert Camus made in his writings, in his essays in 1946 and 47, saying that the concept of total war was a new concept. And some people had suggested to me, well, he was just wrong. But at least theoretically, practically, war is an extremely violent and very difficult human event to control. But theoretically, he seems to have been right. Up until, from what I could find, 1862, there was a concept of war that one group of combatants would face another group of combatants in a contest to see who would win and who would make the other side give concessions. Those concessions might be great. The combatants might be spread over a large area. But there was a clear distinction made, at least theoretically, between civilians and combatants. In 1862, in the war between the states, the war in Canada, which is often referred to as the American Civil War, the Northern forces, the Union forces, were not doing well against the Confederacy. There was a rather large group of generals who approached the current president of the United States and Abraham Lincoln, and they said, "Our hands are being tied in this war, and unless we can do more, we're going to lose." Mr. Lincoln called a general, Ulysses Grant. Those of you familiar with classical history might find a particular irony in his name being Ulysses, or in the Greek, Odysseus. Anyways, after some meetings with commanders in the field, he made what a historian has said was the first plan, if we can call it that, the first permission for total war. What he basically said was, and I'm certainly abbreviating, "We must do whatever it takes to win." In other words, we must win at every cost, at any cost, and lastly, and most importantly, everything is permitted. So we see a shift now where not only are civilians, but any part of the environment is now open to attack in this idea of total war. And the idea of total war is the one side says anybody associated with the other side, supporting it, any area or material support are all legitimate targets in this battle. I'll just mention in passing a few to give you an idea of the scope of the impact of the wounds on our environment. In the Second World War, 247,000 acres of forest were destroyed, 80% of the forest in France, 247,000 acres. These destructions occurred both incidentally as a result of bombing and forest fires that started, and purposely as a matter of military strategy or tactics. I almost hate to mention this because I'm not talking about the human casualties now, but I will. Think for a minute of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. An attack and a destruction on the air, the water, and the earth, which remained radioactive for a long time. Much of the earth which has been removed is still radioactive. In the Second World War, in 1943, the German government, under the Nazi government, decided that there were two large areas of the Ruhr Valley that should be destroyed. There were two large dams, the Eder Dam and the Mur Dam, and they did a very good engineering job. They didn't even bother bombing them and scraping them with planes. They wanted the dams to burst completely, and they wanted the valleys flooded. And so they sent engineers in, and they did a destruction, blew both dams. One of them, approximately 120 million liters of water. The other, about 200 liters of water. And they flooded the valley and did what floods do. Terrible destruction, long-term destruction, in some cases probably permanent destruction of watersheds. The chemists really got involved in the war in Vietnam. One of the major goals in fighting a tropical war was defoliation. It was very irritating to groups that other groups could hide in the jungle. The best thing to do, of course, is to remove the jungle. They had a number of agents. They got colors because they wanted the right helicopters and bombers to load the right barrels, so they colored the barrels. The one you're maybe most familiar with is that one that came in orange barrels, which was called Agent Orange. It was a mixture of two very potent herbicides, which also turned out to be carcinogens. Here in British Columbia, we're probably familiar, if you think back to 2,4-D, BC Hydro, had used 2,4-D for a while to try to defoliate underneath the power lines and eventually withdrew it. Anyways, Agent Orange was a mixture of 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T. Hundreds of millions of tons, that's right, hundreds of millions of tons of Agent Orange were dropped on Vietnam, on the jungles, to help the war effort. There was also Agent Blue. Agent Blue was a specific arsenic poison that worked really good against rice paddies. And because it was arsenic, it had the advantage not only of destroying the rice crops at the time, but of course it infiltrated the top layer of the soil, so you wouldn't be able to grow rice for some time. There was Agent White. Agent White is a persistent chlorohydrocarbon, and the advantage of using Agent White was the fact that it would again not defoliate, but if you defoliate it with 2,4-D and 2,4-5-T, the Agent White would ensure that things wouldn't grow there in future. You're looking at about 25 to 35 years as a long-term. It's called a persistent herbicide. It's also Agent Purple, and Agent Purple was another kind of defoliant. It was the war in Vietnam when the first attempts at massive weather modification occurred as part of a military operation. Starting in 1963, the United States Air Force did a lot of cloud seeding. They tried a number of different compounds, but in the end, they relied on what had been an old reliable substance, silver iodide. Silver iodide is very good at seeding clouds, and they were quite effective. The idea originally was to cause muddy roads, but they soon learned by 1965 that if they used a very small area and seeded a lot of clouds, particularly on the rainy side of a mountain, what they could do is they could cause flooding, and the flooding would trigger landslides. None of this material is secret anymore. It's why I'm often dealing with older material. And this material is readily available to people, for example, who use the Internet, because this information has been declassified. So it's not sort of raging conspiracy thought that these kind of things were done. They're now documented officially by the United States government and by the Office for the Environment. We had a new term, a psychological warfare term, with the current war, I guess we can call it that, in Iraq, shock and awe. But I should say a little something about shock and awe and the environment. The weapons that were used in the shock and awe attack, psychologically, were initially environmental weapons. They were used in Vietnam, they were used in some places in the Korean War, and they were also invented and started to be used at the end of the Second World War. And the idea was to go into a heavily forested or jungle area and to clear landing pads. There are two major shock and awe weapons that are declassified and currently used. Most of the material currently being used around the world is classified, and so I have no idea what's going on. But these are things that are currently used and were used. One of them is concussion bombs. And the idea here, the average concussion bomb, this is now U.S. military, I don't know what other militaries use, but this concussion bomb is approximately 7 ton, 7 to 7.5 ton. And it's very, very crude. It's a mixture of ammonium nitrate, which is a kind of fertilizer, and finely powdered aluminum with a trigger. And the concussion bomb is usually exploded about 3 to 5 meters above the earth. So it comes down and it blows up in the air. And the idea of it is to level an area, to clear an area, so that a landing pad for helicopters will be formed. This particular one, called the 713, will clear an area of 3 to 4 acres. And when you see the pictures where they did the testing, basically it reduces trees and everything to toothpicks and scatter, and then a copter can come down, and it can come down quite rapidly. Basically, use a concussion bomb, you make sure that the area is flat, and within 20 minutes you can land a helicopter. The other kind is what's called a fuel-air explosion, and these were more used as psychological warfare. But they also were originally designed to provide landing areas. And I'll just read a couple of items here that I found. They're a smaller weapon. What they do, again, very, very simple. As they come down, they are now at about 10 meters, and they spray a very fine mist of fuel. Often it's a petroleum-based product, and then they ignite it. So you have basically a tiny firestorm, about a half an acre firestorm just above the earth. This, of course, causes an enormous concussion wave that comes out. And this concussion wave now is not simply sound as it was from the previous kind of bomb, but it's fire. It's sort of, it's a little tiny firestorm. Now, what it does is it creates an area of 2.5 acres of clearance so that a small helicopter can come down. But what I found particularly devilish, diabolical, is a little footnote when you're reading about this. And it says, the LD-50 is 25 acres. Okay, let me explain to you an LD-50. L stands for lethal. D stands for dose. 50 stands for 50%. So when they say an LD-50 of 25 acres, it means in a 25-acre area underneath this bomb, 50% of all life will cease. You can see why it can be used as a psychological warfare weapon, and this was the discovery of the current Pentagon designers prior to this most recent war, that it could also be used against humans because it was so scary. Now, I'd like to move, for sure, to impacts after the war. In any of these cases, you could sort of generalize. I'm just trying to point out the damage to planet Earth that this activity brings about. After a war, you've got a lot of junk left over. You've got a lot of weaponry, a lot of ordnance. To give you an example of what's called post-war disposal, in 1946, 21 German warships filled with unexploded munitions and weapons were sunk at the Skagit seabed. That would be between, if you've got, let's see, if you're looking this way, here's Norway, and here's Sweden and Denmark, so up above the North Sea there. And that was disposal. They were sunk. A lot of Danish fishers sued their government, and eventually in 1986, the Danish government, in an out-of-court settlement, after fighting in court for almost 40 years, began compensating the fishers, the Danish fishers who fish in that area, because their fishery was so destroyed by, still today, the leaking chemicals from those ships. Anyways, that's called post-war disposal. As you probably know, there's a lot of non-post-war disposal. Landmines. I read that in 2004, it was estimated that the country of Libya, you remember Libya is a pretty small country when you're looking on the map, Libya still has five, these numbers always, I'm afraid that you'll think I'm misreading it, 5 million landmines are still buried within the country of Libya.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM, Co-op Radio in Vancouver. Tuesday, on the local Brown Bagger program, we're listening to a speech by Chuck Sigmund from Langara College. His topic is Global Warming Blues, the Impact of War on the Environment.
There's a whole nother area that's come about, and I'm just going to pass on it. I could certainly talk with you a long while about this, but this is depleted uranium. If you have a weapon and those people who are your opposition build things that protect themselves from the weapon, then you try to make the weapon more dense so that you can penetrate their defenses. It's been traditional since early times to use lead bullets because lead is so dense. It so happens, though, that uranium is more dense than lead. Therefore, it can penetrate, say, a tank or an armored vehicle. It has more penetrating power than a lead shell. Now, it would be hard to simply go and manufacture uranium for these purposes. But lo and behold, throughout the world, we have more and more uranium-fueled power plants. Now, the uranium, when it's first put into the power plant, can be very, very hot. That's what you want. You want a source of heat to heat water to generate power through turbines. But uranium fuel, like any fuel, gets consumed. As it gets consumed, it gets cooler. Eventually, it gets too cool to make for an efficient fuel. At that point, it goes from being what's called uranium fuel to depleted uranium fuel. Depleted, meaning it's lost a lot of its heat. But it hasn't lost all its heat. It hasn't lost all its radioactivity. But it still doesn't have much usable heat. But it still is radioactive. Depleted uranium will still be radioactive and harmful to organisms of all sorts, including humans, for another 500,000 years. This depleted uranium can be formed into bullets, into projectiles. Now, you don't want the good guys who handle it, who are going to shoot it, to be exposed to it, so you coat it with lead. And if you coat it with lead, now, there are arguments about this. There are American men and women who used depleted uranium in the first Gulf War. They're sick, and they're saying it was the depleted uranium. Okay, I'm not going to get into that. But the military says no. As long as it has this lead coating on it, it can be handled and put in anti-tank weapons, which is primarily what it's being used for today and what it was used for then. Now, when the shell comes out of the rifled barrel, the lead comes off. It's not purposeful. I don't think it's purposeful. But anyways, it's a fact. So now you have these shells lying around, lots of them lying around the desert, lots of them in Kuwait, lots of them in Iraq. And they're hot items. They're dangerous to living things. And there they are. Also, there's this crazy thing. I don't know. I guess it's a habit of not cleaning up after you. That we have a lot of support materials left all over the world. By we, I mean humans, not just Canadians, but human beings. To give you an idea of the new age of support materials, I thought this one number, it brought something to my mind. In Gulf War I, as it's called on the Pentagon website, the U.S. troops were given MREs. MREs are meals ready to eat. And they're all packaged. Everyone is packaged in a single plastic container. I did a quick calculation. This has no exaggeration. You can do the calculation yourself. The U.S. troops only would have 6 million plastic, ready-to-eat bags a week to dispose of. If you see any pictures, recent pictures of destroyed tanks and that in that area of the desert, you'll see lots of plastic. Of course, I'm sure there's lots of other plastic there, but just think of that. Moving in an army and having 6 million plastic bags a week as throwaway items from your MREs, your meals ready to eat. Anyways, you sort of get that concept of going into an area with large numbers of people, throwing away things. There we are. Also, it seems to be that at the end of the war, I'm particularly interested in that war because there's so much visual presentation. You can look at pictures. There's even webcams where you can look at areas in Kuwait where there's large amounts of desert, and there are the remains of bombed out tanks, the remains of jeeps, the remains of the war, some partly under the sand, some not under the sand anyways. Of course, you see also when you move out after the war, you could take the example of the dams or the heavy rainfall, you have all sorts of erosion problems. Whole rivers have been moved. The whole idea of waterscape, of watersheds, is all altered. The flows of the natural environments are changed. After the war in the former Yugoslavia, for example, you can see areas all around the farm area below Zagreb where, because of the bombing and because of some dams that had been released, new streams were formed. Massive erosion occurred, and a large amount of very fertile topsoil was washed away during this process. Now, of course, in addition to a war and a post-war, you have to be ready for war. You have to prepare. There are so many problems of toxic contamination. Now, I should say that quite a few of the countries that are big war producers, France, England, Canada, the U.S., we're smart. And we got ministers of the environment, we've got ministries of the environment. But in all of these countries, including our own, if you're doing weapons testing, two things happen. Number one, if you can make a good case to the ministry that what you do is important, but it's going to violate some environmental regulations, the minister can say, look, for the sake of national security, the environmental regulations will be suspended temporarily while you carry out this research. Also, there's another thing. You know, regulations among humans, no matter what kind of regulations they are, require enforcement. And enforcement requires inspection. Hey, can you imagine going in and inspecting a place where they're testing weapons, which is a matter of national security? Of course not. You can't let inspectors in. Who knows what they'll see? So the whole idea of environmental protection is at least temporarily thrown out. Locally, we've got some very serious devastation. Over on Vancouver Island, there's a little town called Nanoose, and there's a bay there called Nanoose Bay. It's an underwater weapons testing area. I need say no more. In northern Alberta, we have a low-level bombing and strafing range. It's not only for Canada and the United States, it's for NATO. And every summer, and now increasingly in winter, we make various contracts. We send out various contracts for NATO forces to come and practice their low-range bombing and strafing in northern Alberta. Not good for the environment, not great for the earth. We have really tried to broaden our weapon use. And that's moved us into biological and chemical areas. And they are really, really problematic because as opposed to other kinds of munitions, they get stale dated. They don't last very long. So we design them, we test them, we produce them, and then fairly soon, and we hope we don't have to use them, we have to dispose of them and make new ones. We have to restock. And of course, we have to dispose of them. To give you an idea of disposal, I can't find any recent disposal data again, but the declassified stuff, listen to a couple of these, which are, I mean, they amaze me, and I thought I was sort of beyond amazement of what you can do to the environment. In 1967 and 1968, 1,706 concrete coffins, each which had 30 nerve gas rockets in them from the Second World War, were disposed of in the Atlantic between Florida and Cuba. They were sunk. They were concrete coffins, so, you know, it should be good for quite a long while. In 1970, a U.S. arms ship, again, I always find interesting things in names. This ship is called the New Liberty. Anyways, the New Liberty was sunk 500 kilometers off the coast of Florida. That seems to be a good place to sink ships. Maybe that has something to do with that triangle, that wonderful triangle there. Anyways, that ship was filled with chemical weapons. The nature of the chemical weapons is still classified, presumably because some of them are still in production. But so this is a way of disposing of the things that that you don't use. Another thing that never occurred to me, but I got into once I got into researching this, was simple things like maneuvers. In the year 2000, a group of environmental students from the University of California, the Davis campus, decided to go out to an arid area in California, where that great general, George S. Patton, had trained tank corps in 1941 into maneuvers. Important thing to do, of course. They went out and they looked at that area to see what kind of scars there were in the vegetation and soil. Now, we're talking year 2000, so we're talking 1942 to the year 2000. Their data, which is available on the university website, shows that overall 65% of the vegetation has not come back. And that in the areas where there are actually tank maneuvers, so where the tank tracks are, 82% have not been restored. Now, there was no remediation. This would be natural regrowth and natural restoration. But just on something like a maneuver. Okay, anyways. I want to spend just a few minutes here on the nuclear weapons program, which is also, as you can imagine, really, really hard on the Earth. In the United States, which is not necessarily a leader, France does also a lot of nuclear testing. Russia does. But I have data for the United States. The United States has 280 operating nuclear facilities, nuclear weapons facilities, on 20 sites. They design, test, and produce nuclear weapons. This is of 2006. One of the big ones close to us is the Hanford Reservation. Hanford is over there, sort of below Spokane in Washington, southwest Washington. You can actually, it's right next to Richland. If you get a map and you say, well, I want to see almost any U.S. map, and certainly if you Google Earth, if you go to Google Earth, you'll be able to look and see, it's blotted out some of it, but you can see the Hanford Reservation. Okay, what do they do? They produce plutonium. They're 6 miles from the Columbia River, from the shores of the Columbia River. As of 2002, the latest data I could get, here's what they have disposed of on-site. This is on-site disposal, and they're sort of proud of that, that they don't go shipping this stuff around. They just put it right there on the site when they're done. Okay, it's all imperial because they haven't converted to metric, and I could have used my calculator, but I realized I didn't. Okay, so low-level waste, 18 million cubic feet. This is buried on site. Plutonium-contaminated waste, 3.9 million cubic feet. High-level waste, 8 million cubic feet. All buried in various kinds of containers, some plastic, some concrete, some steel. Okay, not good. I was also thinking about the environment, planet Earth. You know that idea? A lot of people mentioned it. I always attribute it to Buckminster Fuller, but he said, you can't ever throw anything away. You can only throw it around. Okay? Right now, on the planet Earth, the United States has 138 nuclear-powered vessels. These aren't all military vessels. Most of them are. 138. Russia has 565. Now, what does that mean? Well, using some data and making some round figures, but trying not to exaggerate, if I looked at the nuclear weapons ships and the ones carrying nuclear weapons, primarily missiles, I figured that as we're sitting here today, or I'm standing, there are 14,000 nuclear weapons at sea.
You are tuned to CFRO 102.7 FM. That's Co-op Radio right here in Vancouver. It's a Tuesday, and we're playing the local Brown Bagger program. We've got a speech by Chuck Sigmund from Langara College. His topic is Global Warming Blues, the Impact of War on the Environment.
Well, so what can we do? Be all sad and depressed? I hope not. I really believe firmly, and I guess it's a belief, although I think there is evidence, but it's probably more a belief, that every single change that has ever occurred and that ever will occur begins with an individual. Sure, there are groups of people and there are communities of people and there are coalitions, but they're made up of individuals. We are individuals. We can join hands and share and make communities, but in the end, we have the biggest control over ourselves. And so, what I'd really like to see is I'd like to see people on an individual level start making harm-free zones. Now, my idea is that this is basically an approach to decrease warlike behavior. Because warlike behavior, again, starts with individuals. It doesn't start with some kinds of machines or some kinds of particularly evil species of human being or somebody who's, you know, genetically deformed. There clearly aren't enough psychopaths or sociopaths in the world to carry out wars. Wars have to be carried out and supported by people like us in this room. And I assert, and I think it's a particularly emotionally appealing assertion, that violence hurts everybody always. I've written down, in no particular order, on a particularly optimistic afternoon, some steps that I thought I could take and other humans could take that would begin undermining war and its impact on all living organisms and our planet and ourselves. It's important to undermine the support that we have in our society, that we have individually, for violent conflict resolution. It is inevitable that there are going to be stresses and conflicts between human beings, between loving human beings and between human beings who don't love each other, and between human beings who dislike each other. Tensions arise because we're individuals, and tensions are going to result in conflicts. And we have to try to resolve all our conflicts without pounding on the other people, without trying to stick something in their eye. This is no way to behave, because this is how the violence that builds into war gets started. So you have to work against violence at every level. And you have to keep remembering, this is important, I think, that there's no step too small. There's no thing that's too tiny. I hate that idea when somebody comes to me and says, this is a trivial action. Or, oh yes, you know, we know what this is. This is just for show. Any change in the right direction is a positive change. You have to learn and practice. We have to learn as a species, but we also have to learn individually ways of resolving conflict with nonviolent means, to de-escalate things as much as we can. And we can do that in our own lives. We can even do that in our own selves. You know, you're like me. At times, you're of two minds. And sort of your left and your right hemisphere fight with each other. And you've got to figure out how to live with that without getting angry and pounding the wall or saying bad things to somebody else or just getting in a bad funk. We have to not be concerned about how our negotiating our path through life is seen. You know, in any kind of a culture, whether it's a male-dominated culture or it's a more equal culture, there's this whole idea we don't want to appear weak, or we don't want to appear soft, or we don't want to be a pushover, or we don't want to be a doormat. We've got to ignore that. We've got to utilize the kind of inner strength that, say, that Mahatma Gandhi talked about. And we've got to do what we believe is right, regardless of how we might appear to other people. I think a really important thing is that we have to be realistic. That is, we can't expect to change the world unless our country changes, but we can't expect our country to change unless our province changes. But that won't change unless our community changes, and that won't change unless our family changes, and that won't change unless we change. And change is hard. It's difficult. We have all kinds of tendencies. We have this really complicated brain. You can talk about it all kinds of ways. My favorite way is a Carl Sagan way, which you have this R complex. He sometimes called it, no offense to reptilians who might be hiding underneath the floorboards, but he calls it the reptilian complex. It's the limbic region, the area from which basic kinds of anger and fear are. And then over that is another post-limbic area. And then his optimism is up on the top. We have this cortex. He calls it the neocortex. And he's convinced, and I am too, that the neocortex can control those earlier areas, those more primitive areas of the brain. But it takes a lot of effort. And it takes practice. And practice is the best kind of teacher. I've never been convinced that preaching or righteous groups, you know, by righteous groups, I just mean, you know, groups that are shaking their finger at the bad ones. We're the good ones. You guys, oh, shame on you. I think that that's an important phrase, shame on you. I don't think shame, which goes down to the limbic region, to the more primitive region, is a very good way to change behavior. I think that's probably a very bad way to change behavior. I think probably the best way to change behavior is to model behavior. That is to just, and somebody say, oh, That didn't seem to bloody your neighbor as much as my tactic. I mean, I don't like blooding my neighbor either. Anyways, so there it goes. And my last thing is to sort of practice something which I've always called Zen wisdom, but it simply means in existential terms to be concrete, to see things for what they are. A thing is a thing. A bomb is a bomb. You don't have a humanitarian bomb. You don't have a humanitarian war. When you go into a forest, you don't have lumber ready to be cut and shipped and sold. You have a forest. You have a living forest. A tree's a tree. It's got its own life. It's doing things. We may want to saw it down and cut it into lumber, but it's a tree. So I think we've got to really be careful with analogies and inner symbolisms and icons and say, well, this looks like something, but listen to me, I know it's really something else. Be skeptical. Say, hey, a thing is a thing. It is what it is. I want to conclude with a reading and a poem. The reading is very small. Carl Sagan, some of you probably know of Carl Sagan. He was an astronomer. It's not important if you know him or not. His anniversary of his death was earlier this year, and his wife, Ann Druin, wrote a long article about Carl and about her and about the Earth, about the planet, about global warming, about war, about the future of humankind. She was very optimistic. I like her. I like her thoughts. Toward the end of that article, she's talking generally about violence, and she has this paragraph, which I'll share with you. I think you'll appreciate it. She says, "To find that from the distance of Neptune, the Earth is a one-pixel world, that perspective gives the lie to every ideology that justifies murder and mayhem. To see that dot is to realize we are a bunch of fruit flies bickering over a grape. If you have that perspective of the world, the idea that everything in the universe was not created for the benefit of one tiny group on one pale blue dot, then you can't bring yourself to be a suicide bomber or a terrorist, or to make war against poor people and the defenseless. And in a war, all the victims are poor and defenseless." I'd like to conclude today with a poem. It's called "Let No Charitable Hope." It's by Eleanor Wiley. "Let no charitable hope confirm my mind and confuse it with images of eagle and of antelope. I am, in nature, none of these. I was, being human, born alone. I am, being woman, hard beset. I live by squeezing from a stone the little nourishment I get. In masks outrageous and austere, the years go by in single file, but none has merited my fear, and none has quite escaped my smile." I thank you.
That was Chuck Sigmund wrapping up the Langara College Speaker Series at the Vancouver Public Library on November 28, 2007. This recording was made by CFRO, Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Tune in at 102.7 FM or via the net at www.cooperadio.org. That's coopradio.org. We'll close out with the Canadian artist Joni Mitchell, her Woodstock song "Where Bomber Death Planes Become Butterflies," as we turn back to nature. Thank you.
beats the time of man. I don't know who I am, but you know life is for learning. We are stardust, we are golden, and we got to get ourselves back to the dream.